We're talking with Isabel Wilkerson, author of The Warmth of Other Suns. I'm Christopher Lydon. Isabel Wilkerson, we're talking about the setting out and what that took, but then there was the getting there. You refer to the North, both East and West. In the book, it's referred to as the kinder mistress. But these were difficult receptions in Chicago, in New York, even in Los Angeles. Tell some of that story about the fear, again, the threat of violence, but also the amazingly foresighted Chicago Commission on Race Relations right around World War I.
Yes. Again, as I was saying about the great tragedy, is there was great fear, misunderstanding, suspicion, and wariness about the arrival of African Americans in such large numbers. In the case of a family called the Clarks, as they attempted to move into this apartment building in Cicero, Illinois, just on the western border of Chicago, they were so excited to have found this apartment because they had been living in a two-room apartment with another family. So basically, had like 10 people living in a two-room flat on the south side of Chicago for a huge amount of money. They found a cheaper apartment, five rooms, and they were so excited to move in. When they tried to move in, they were not permitted to by the sheriff. They had to get a court order in order to move in. Eventually, when they were able to move in, they could move their belongings in, but they themselves could move in. The night that their belongings were moved in, a mob of several thousand gathered around them. And of course, these were sadly immigrants who had just arrived not long before themselves, and they gathered around and they stormed the apartment, the second floor apartment, threw out the sofa, the chairs, the piano, all of their belongings, the children's pictures, the wedding pictures, all of that they threw out the second floor window. Then they went and tore out the radiators, the sinks, the fixtures, the faucets, and threw all of them out the window as well. Then they set the pile of belongings on fire. Then they set the building on fire, which then left the white residents who were living in the building homeless. Mm. That was the early 50s.
Even in New York, this is 1963, your man George Starling, up from Citrus, Florida, is wondering what in the world he's done. Can I read this paragraph?
Yes.
George Swanson Starling, 1963, New York. Something welled up in George. Everything raced before him. The cheating foreman in the groves, his running for his life, the hangings and burnings, the little southern dog that would rather die than be black, the bomb going off on Christmas Day under the bed of a good man trying to bring justice to Florida. And then there was New York, wide open and stifling at the same time. Yes, he was alive, but it was a slow death in a hard city. He was a baggage handler, for all intents and purposes, and would be no more than that, no matter how much potential he had.
Yes, it was a difficult adjustment to what he had hoped would be a fuller life, and it turned out that the North was not what he expected it to be. Yes, he was freer to do certain things, but there would arise a moment where Jim Crow seemed to be following him. And one of those cases was where he had gotten back from a long run on the train. And he always used to look forward to coming to the North because it was always less stress just being in the North. I mean, he didn't have to worry about, getting on the bad side of a sheriff just because he didn't say sir. I mean, it was just a freer world in so many ways. And so he always felt relaxed when he got back to New York. However, this time he went to get a drink at a bar near Penn Station, which is where he operated out of as a railroad porter. And they stopped at the bar, got their glass of beer. After they had finished them, they set the glasses down. The bartender quietly and without comment took the glasses and smashed them against the counter where all the other patrons looked and could see that what the bartender had done was that he had broken the glasses because if they had touched the lips of a person who was black, they were no longer fit to be used for by anyone else. And that stayed with him and reminded him that there could still be moments when he could be reminded of the caste that he had been born into, even in New York.
Isabel Wilkerson, can I ask you, just as a matter of method, who elicited all these stories? Did you do all the interviews on all your principal subjects, or what? I mean, the stories themselves, the storytellers, are so brilliantly chosen and then given so much encouragement here.
I conducted interviews with over 1,200 people. In the course of doing the interviews with these people, I had a researcher who was helping me track down the best places to go to find them. I went to AARP meetings. I went to senior centers. I went to Baptist churches, Catholic mass. I went to churches in New York where everyone was from South Carolina. I mean, I went to high school reunions and all kinds of places where it could be thought that people who had migrated would be, senior citizens would be. And so I had help with some of the initial interviewing, but the relationships with and the interviews with the three main characters were by me. I went to the South with two of the three people. Robert Foster had no desire to go back, so he did not. But Ida Mae Gladney and George Swanson Starling did agree to go back. And, you know, I had a wonderful experience with Ida Mae Gladney in particular, who, when we got to cotton fields, she actually wanted to stop and pick some. I mean, she hadn't wanted to pick when she was a sharecropper, but now that she didn't have to, and we got there, and she hadn't been to Mississippi in decades, and she saw it, and something made her feel like she wanted to get out. I said, "Are you sure we can pick in this field? I mean, this land belongs to somebody, and besides that, we're in Mississippi." And she said, "Oh, they won't care what little bit we're about to pick." And so we got out there. We spent maybe 10 minutes, you know, just, I had never even seen cotton growing before, but it was, you know, she went out there and I got out there and I took pictures, and some of them would be on the website. And she just enjoyed it. And then we got back in the car and we went on about our way to visit some of the people that she knew or those that we could find. So
she was how old by then?
She was in her 80s. She was in her late 80s by then. But she had the energy to get out there, jump out of the car and go out into that field.
Let's talk about the hard part, as these lives approach their ends, and you see them all to their graves in this book, their lives in some were difficult, and their next generation was even more troubled in certain ways. Start with Ida Mae, who lived peacefully in Chicago, surrounded by family and her church and her work, but surrounded also by crime like crazy on the South Side, dope, helplessness. This is a very grim place to have escaped to.
Yes, it is. I mean, what had happened was she and her family, like many immigrants actually, decided that they would move as multiple generations into a three flat, meaning an apartment with three, apartment building with three actual apartments in it. And it would be her, it would be three generations that would be living in this one apartment building. And they thought it was wonderful. It was a lovely Italian family that sold the house to them. But within months, the neighborhood had turned from all white to completely black. And in doing so, so did the bakery. The bakery left, the ice cream parlor left, all of those things that make for a neighborhood left as the proprietors left as well. And then they were replaced with liquor stores and payday loan places. That it happened so quickly that the neighborhood was really never able to recover. No one wanted to invest in the neighborhood anymore. And then she found herself surrounded by people who were no longer owners because they had the turnover had happened so quickly. And she was surrounded by people who ultimately might have been dealing drugs or in gangs, and she found that was what had occurred to the neighborhood that she had so loved when she first arrived. Oddly enough, though, she was such a warm and loving person that even they liked her and they looked out for her and they would warn her to stay inside because we're going to be shooting this afternoon.
Oh, Lord. But she looks out her window at tremendous degradation. It's a very sad scene. Talk about George Starling, who had an unhappy marriage, children in and out of wedlock, but a tragic adventure with drugs in the next generation.
Yes. He is an example of how the children, because he and his wife were working so hard. It's my contention that one of the things that happened to this next generation was several things. One is their parents were extraordinarily hard workers, and because they were hard workers, they were not always able to be there when the children got out of school. Secondly, they had come from small towns where they were surrounded by neighbors and friends and family. And even though life was very difficult because of Jim Crow, they still had, there were lots of eyes and ears watching out for their children. Here, that wasn't the case. And they were not accustomed to the dangers of the North. They could not even anticipate or have the idea of what might be happening out there in the streets. They couldn't fathom what was happening. They did not anticipate how bad it could be in these crowded, overcrowded, dangerous streets that were drawing in their children. And he was one who essentially lost his son and, in a way, his daughter to the streets of New York.
And then finally, among your big three, there's Dr. Foster. Ray Charles's Dr. Foster in that song, Hide No Hair. He has a very successful private practice for a while. He ends up kind of willy-nilly in a VA medical center under a lot of bureaucratic pressure and maybe racial disdain too. His heart is weakening before he dies. He's in trouble at the end. But the thing I'd like you to dwell on, Isabel, is that all of these three migrants come to a point in their lives when they are asking themselves, would they have been better off in the South?
They do ask themselves that. We would talk about that quite a bit. And it turned out that they would all have said, and they all did say, they would say that we've made many mistakes in our lives, but leaving the South was not one of them.
And do you agree?
I would absolutely agree, because in some ways, however you want to define success, for them, remembering what they were leaving, remembering the world of Bill Russell's parents, remembering the world that they were living in, even though life was not perfect, they had such modest goals. They were not looking to run Fortune 500 companies and to own skyscrapers. They were looking to be able to get in line, get gas in the order in which they had arrived. They were looking to be able to have their children be able to go to a school where they could actually take a book out of the library. They had very modest goals. So when you think about the modest goals of these people who were like, any immigrant group who might have come here just wanting to be able to, to survive in the new world in hopes that life might be better. In some ways, leaving was its own point. Getting out was its own point. This migration helped to lead, we've talked about literature, high literature, we've talked about music, we've talked about sports. But politically, this migration was huge because many of the states of the North and the West, which we consider to be blue states, are blue states in part because of this transfer of people who had never voted before, but now were in the North and the West and were able to vote. And they ended up voting as Democrats, loyal blue people, you might say, often. That was one thing. Secondly, this great migration in some ways paved the way for the civil rights movement or the human rights movement, as I like to call it, which then led the way to other freedom movements for women and for other groups. And that was because the people who left showed that the members of this lower caste system that had been defined by Jim Crow in the South had options that it did not have before, and they were willing to act upon them. Secondly, these people provided leverage for those who stayed and were the ones who were bearing up under the sheriff's dogs and those hoses. And they provided a kind of leverage because these people who had to fight that final battle for civil rights, they knew that there was a place that they could go if things got too difficult for them. They knew that there was also another way. They had not been exposed to the options of the North. The options of the North didn't exist for them before the Great Migration occurred. And so the migration provided leverage for those who stayed and fought the final battle. And then finally, the people who left also provided financing for the civil rights movement and for the people in the South who were depending on it. How typical is it of the immigrant to want to take care of those back home because they're making more money up in the North and they would send money back. And that helped to also fuel the effort toward civil rights and the legislation that that changed finally the South and made it a place where now the children and grandchildren of the Great Migration can participate in what's called a reverse migration because the reasons for the original Great Migration had been resolved to a large degree, not completely, but to a great degree.
Let's go out on the Count Basie Band, if we may. So many children of the Great Migration in the band playing Midnight Blue. Can I give you one, my own reader's definition of the victory here?
Yes, it seems I'd love to hear that, it.
Well, you know, I just keep thinking in all of these stories vindicate the genius of the individual, of human gifts when given opportunity, and the fruits that are sort of waiting there to be recognized. And it also speaks incredibly well overall, it seems to me, over the span of a century and hundreds, thousands, millions of lives, about the process of adaptation in this country. One of the things I kept thinking was, if China and India, in their own processes of fantastically huge migration now, if they come out of the process with individuals that will have changed their cultures as expressively and as profoundly, even for the whole world to notice and enjoy, as the Black Americans of the 20th century did, they'll be very lucky. I mean, it is a marvelous record overall, it seems to me, of a country and a culture dealing with the challenge to recognize unrecognized people, to touch the untouchables, and then to deal with them and to hear from them in glory.
You're absolutely right. I think that the world will be lucky if we can see a similar outgrowth and outpouring of artistic expression and other kinds of expression. Because ultimately, this was a leaderless revolution in which the individuals defied their own leaders who had told them, stay in the South, this is the land of the forefathers, this is the land that our forefathers worked for free, and we must stay here and maintain our role here because this is where we belong. The people didn't listen to it. The people went out and did exactly what their hearts told them to do, and that meant that, as you described it, the genius of the individual, the power of the individual. To me, it's an inspiration to everyone who is the descendant of someone who participated in this or any other migration experience, and that is that if they could do that, then what is it that we can do? There's nothing that we can't do if you think of it that way. What a legacy they've left for all of us. What a legacy they've left of courage and great heart. Great heart. I get filled with inspiration just thinking about it, and I have such a more enormous gratitude for my parents for what they did and for all of these people and for anyone who would participate in, who would leave a place so far away for some place that they'd never seen. I'm just filled with gratitude.
Isabel Wilkerson, I'm grateful to you for telling such an extraordinary story so beautifully. I hadn't quite realized that you did all the interviewing yourself. It's a phenomenal accomplishment and a deeply moving one at any level, in any part of the world, to think of migrants in this frame. Isabel Wilkerson, thank you. Thank you for the warmth of Other Suns. Thank you for the warmth of this conversation.
Thank you for having me.
Ben Mandelkern and Katie Okamoto produced and edited this conversation with Isabel Wilkerson. Her book is The Warmth of Other Suns. Listeners, please finish up the conversation with a comment on our website, radioopensource.org. I'm Christopher Leiden. Thank you for being part of this conversation.